external masses, because the external momenta, by the time we get to this master equations, are sums of the original momenta in the problem, which are, of course, all massless. I won't write down the full set again today, but just remind you of some of them. So again, so this, which we might call, I don't know, P1, is going to be some sum of original momenta in our problem. So this is the easy two-mass box, and then there's the three-mass, four-mass, and then one, two, and three-mass triangles and bubbles. We started out with a direct correspondence between, in fact, this is an equation we're going to want to refer to a lot, so let me box it and I'll leave it up. So in the original version of the unitarity method, we were identifying two propagators. And that is what has a direct interpretation as an absorptive part, as a phase space integral. But we noticed that we can actually look for contributions that have more than two propagators. And as we discussed, we could go up to insisting that there be four propagators present, and then we clearly so this has a direct unitarity interpretation. And four propagators, we get rid of the triangles and we isolate a specific box. So for example, if I insisted that I have the propagators in between leg 1 and leg n, and in between leg r and r plus 1, then, and so on and so forth around the box, I'm going to pick out a specific box integral. So where we're going is that we're going to cut those specific four propagators, so it's a quadruple cut, and we're going to apply that to both sides of this equation with the goal of extracting an equation for the coefficient Cj. So let's in fact start by doing this on the right-hand side. So we should just write down our box integral. And here I'm going to label the legs of the box by k's again. Let's see here. Anyway, so let's start by writing down our box integral. So we need to do the integral itself in d dimensions, because otherwise we're going to have infrared divergences. You can see by power counting this particular integral has no ultraviolet divergences. But from the point of view of actually everything that we're going to do today, the difference between 4 and d dimensions doesn't really matter very much. And you can carry along this extra dimension, but it doesn't really illuminate anything. So I'm going to go back to being a physicist and not try to pretend to be a mathematician and write down an expression which is actually ill-defined. But it's ill-defined in a way that we know how to cure. It's just the infrared divergences that are there. And the next thing we want to do is we want to apply the quadruple cut. So what we want to do is to follow Kutkusky and replace each of these propagators by delta functions. In fact, we're supposed to replace them by positive energy delta functions, I'm going to ignore the various constant factors that are in front. So we have delta L minus P1 squared delta plus L minus P12 squared delta plus L minus P123 squared. So what these delta functions are first of all telling us to do is to solve the simultaneous equations L squared equals 0, L minus P1 squared equals 0, and L minus P12 squared equals 0. Let me write these separately. Well, it'll actually be more convenient to write this, use momentum conservation to write this in terms of the fourth momentum. So L is a loop momentum. It has 4 degrees of freedom. We have 4 equations, which you're supposed to solve simultaneously. It turns out that counting the number of solutions to simultaneous polynomial, higher degree polynomial equations is not a completely trivial exercise. You might think, well, we have 4 quadratic equations, there should be 16 solutions, or maybe it's just quadratic, there should be 2 solutions. But you can take linear combinations of these equations, so you can reduce them to the set L squared equals 0, minus 2L dot P1 plus P1 squared equals 0, minus 2 L dot K2, P2, excuse me, plus S12 minus P1 squared equals 0, and 2 L dot K4, P4 squared equals 0. So now we have 1 quadratic equation and 3 linear equations, so in fact we expect to have 2 solutions. And that turns out to be correct. Let's look at a special case, something that corresponds to P1 squared and P4 squared vanishing. So we have a 1 or 2 mass situation. So we're going to go back to simple box in which these might have in fact been the original momenta in our n point amplitude problem. And we can now use spinner representation to write down our solutions. So one solution we can write down in the following form. There's going to be some normalization, and we're going to write it down in terms of the angle spinner for leg 1 and the bracket spinner for leg 4. Why is that a useful thing to do? Well, we can see, first of all, this is because it's a product of a lambda spinner and a lambda tilde spinner, it's going to be a massless momentum. So it's going to satisfy this equation automatically. And P1 squared here we're setting to 0, so we just have the dot product of that with P1, but that's going to give us an angle product of 1 with 1, so this equation is automatically satisfied. Likewise, P4 squared we're taking to be 0, so we have this loop momentum dotted with P4. That's going to give us a bracket product of P4 with itself, so that again is going to vanish. And we have one equation left over, which we can impose, and that'll fix the value of xi. And so if we impose that third equation, we'll find that xi is equal to S12 divided by 1, 2, 4. So again, that's the P2 dotted into this vector here made up of the angle 1 spinner and the bracket 4 spinner. Now, there was nothing particularly special about angle 1 and bracket 4. I could have done it the other way around. And so, in fact, I have another solution which has this form, and where the C prime, as you might be able to guess, is just has the two rolls of the two spinners flipped. Okay, so we have our two solutions. So we can now think about doing the integral. But we now immediately see that there's a problem. These solutions are complex. So they're complex vectors, manifestly complex vectors. In general, bracket 1 is not the conjugate of angle 4. That would require very special external kinematics. So we know that when we're doing an integral over a delta function, then if we have some function, now we have delta minus x naught, well, we're supposed to evaluate the function at x naught, but that's on condition that x naught actually lie in the domain of integration. And if there are multiple solutions, we're supposed to sum over those solutions. But here, the solutions, we're doing a real integral, the integral over L1, L2, L3 are all real integrals, and the solutions are complex. So that means that the solutions to these constraint equations are not in the domain of integration. If we integrate over these delta functions, we're simply going to get zero. Now, if we do that on the left-hand side of our master equation, the same thing is going to happen. And so the cut integral on both sides is going to vanish, and we're going to find the result that says 0 is equal to 0. So there's no inconsistency here, but it's just not very useful. So what we need to do is to redefine what we mean by cutting instead of putting in a positive energy delta function. Of course, with a complex vector, another problem is we don't even really know what do you mean by positive energy. Should I be taking the positive part of the real part or the positive part of the complex part? We've already seen a hint of that in this morning's lectures, that delta functions should be interpreted as contour integrals. And the idea is that we've started out with an integral that's taken along the real axis. So if you now think we're going to complexify the space of momenta L from Minkowski space or from a four-dimensional real space to a four-dimensional complex space, and this original integral was taken along the real slice, so we had a fourfold contour where each of the different components is taken along a contour that's along the real axis. And now we're going to change that contour in order to impose a delta function. So let's suppose we have some polynomial in z, in some complex variable z, and let's suppose it has a simple root at z0. And let's imagine that, or I should say actually it has a simple root at z0, so this polynomial at z0 minus a simply vanishes. So if we write down a contour integral, if you think back to your complex variables course, then if we have some polynomial in z, and we have we call this polynomial 2, we're doing a contour integral, and this is a contour, some circle that surrounds z0. So in fact, the way it behaves is very, very similar to a delta function, because it's going to essentially pick out the value of the numerator polynomial at z0. In fact, if we do this, then we find the following formula. We have the numerator polynomial evaluated at the location of the pole divided by the derivative of the denominator polynomial evaluated at the pole. And that's very, very similar to the formula we would get for doing a delta function if instead we had, now going back to, for a second, to a real variable, we had a polynomial in x, and we had the same polynomial minus a inside a delta function, then as long as x naught was inside the domain of integration, then we would find polynomial 1 as a function of x naught divided by the absolute value of the derivative of polynomial 2 evaluated at that same x naught. So there is one difference between these two that's very important. Here there's an absolute value, and here there's no absolute value. So in particular, if we imagine that we're starting with an analytic function, so we have an analytic function, if we've relaxed the constraint that the lambda tilde spinners have to be complex conjugates to the lambda ones, they're now independent, our functions are generally analytic functions in lambda and lambda tilde separately. So when we do one of these contour integrals, when we do one of these redefined delta functions, we're going to still get an analytic function. If we had this absolute value, then we'd be getting a non-analytic function, and that's important. So in the present context, what we're going to do is where we see one of these delta functions, and so we have, now we've complexified the loop momentum, so instead of it being an x, a real variable, it's really a z, we're simply going to define the delta functions that the Katkowski rule would have given us. We're going to define them to be the contour integral surrounding the pole. Or equivalently, instead of doing a cutting by imposing the Katkowski rule, we're going to do a cut by integrating around a carefully chosen contour. So I want to emphasize that this is not a contour deformation. It's not the usual kind of game one is playing in complex analysis where you try and shift the contours in order to find a more favorable contour to calculate your integral. But you're trying to leave the value of the integral unchanged. Here, you are changing the contour and you are changing the value of the object that you're calculating. The purpose is different. So when we change the contour from something running along the real slice to something encircling the pole, we are not trying to calculate the integral by making a clever choice of contours. We're modifying the result of what we're getting. And the reason we're modifying it, we'll see as we go on. So in our present context, we're working in four dimensions. We're trying to solve four simultaneous equations. So instead of a simple pole in a single variable, we actually have what's called a global pole. So in n dimensions, this corresponds to the solution of n simultaneous equations. Now, in fact, the analysis in multiple complex variables has a lot of subtleties that don't arise in single variable complex analysis, but we're not going to get into any of those subtleties. Where we had just a simple circle here surrounding the simple pole in a single complex variable, now our contours are going to be four tori. So they're going to be, and you can think of them as being, in this case, if you have variables that separate so that the pole actually separates, you can imagine having some clever parameterization so that each of these ultimately corresponds to something of the form 1 over z sub I, then your contour is going to be essentially a product of circles, so a one-dimensional circle surrounding the location of the pole in each of the components. More generally, it's going to be just a four torus that encircles this global pole. So in this particular case, the pole is isolated. It really is there. Each of these two poles is a single point in C4. And my artistic skills are not up to drawing a four complex dimensional representation on the blackboard. In fact, I'm not even sure they're up to drawing four real dimensions on the blackboard. So what I'm going to do is instead draw kind of a slice. It's a one complex dimensional slice, let's say in the L0 plane. And we're starting out with a bunch of poles that have to do with the Feynman I epsilon prescription. And we have a contour that runs along the real axis. We're going to get rid of that contour. And instead, we're going to enclose the global poles, which are sitting way out in the complex plane. They're nowhere near the Feynman I epsilons. And again, this is not a contour deformation. I'm throwing away the old contour and I'm using a new one. So there's already one problem that we have here. And it's that I had an original contour, which was a single contour. So at least the integral had whatever its value was. I mean, I go back to D dimensions. It has some given value. Here, I actually have two solutions, two global poles. And so each one of them, there's some four torus that surrounds it. But what should I choose? Should I choose the difference? Should I choose the average? Should I choose one? Should I choose the other? Well, you might think here it's a pretty simple situation. I should take the average in some sense. And that actually turns out to be the correct answer, modulo defining the orientation of these four tori. But in general, that's not, life is not so simple. We may or may not get to see a more sophisticated example at the end of today's lecture. So we have to understand what's the criterion for going about picking the correct contour of integration. And there's a hint from the fact that as we were doing our tensor reductions, if you remember yesterday, we were relying on parity conservation of the integral. So this, in the denominator of our Feynman integral here, it's clearly manifestly going to be, it's manifestly parity invariant, so the result should be parity invariant. That's to say, if we put a Levi-Civita tensor in the numerator, so something of this form, an epsilon symbol, then we should get zero. That's for our original integral, because it's fully anti-symmetric and it's odd under parity. Now, this was something that we relied on in order to derive our basis of integrals. So if we break this equation in the process of cutting, doing a quadruple cut on both sides of the equation, then clearly that's not a legitimate thing to do anymore because we've made that assumption in deriving the equation. And the thing that's very amazing, maybe amusing too, is that these two problems actually cancel each other out. So if we insist that this equation be satisfied, then that'll lead us to a unique choice of contour. So let's imagine that we choose some general contour that's a linear combination of, let me call this C1 and C2. So the mathematicians would insist that A1 and A2 be integers. They'd be called winding numbers, but as far as we're concerned, they could be real numbers or even complex numbers. You can just sit and evaluate the integral along this integral along these two contours, along the contour C. So you write down the integral. Essentially, you're taking the residue at the global pole, so that corresponds to really evaluating the numerator at respectively C1 and C2, and then taking the sum weighted by A1 and A2. You can evaluate this explicitly. There's some function of the external momenta that you get, which is not particularly illuminating. And the thing that is illuminating is that the coefficient of that is A1 minus A2. Yes?
This schema, are you just doing both contours separately, or are they connected in some other dimension?
They are. There's a four torus that encircles this one. There's an independent four torus that encircles this one. And this four torus I'm calling C1. This four torus I'm calling C2. And, well, one thing that is still true in higher dimensions is that contour integration is a multilinear operation. So if I tell you you're integrating along a contour which has disconnected pieces, you integrate along this one, and then you integrate along that one. And again, I'm using this kind of in a sloppy notation. If this were truly a winding number, then of course it would work out that you just get that coefficient in front of the integral. So what I really mean is, integrate over C1, multiply the result by A1, and then add that to the quantity you get by integrating over C2 multiplied by A2. Okay? This really should be a C and not an E. So if I want this equation, which was used in the derivation, to continue to hold, that means that I should choose a special combination of these contours, namely the one that, with an appropriate choice of orientation, is really just the sum of these two global poles. So you're supposed to sum over them with equal weights. Now we're ready to actually derive some useful results. So there's a Jacobian that we get when we do these contour integrals. So we're changing the contour, and then we do the four separate L integrations. But that Jacobian, whatever it is just a constant. And we're going to do this on both sides of the equations, right? So again, we want to go back and think of our amplitude here as a Gedanken calculation in terms of Feynman diagrams. So we write down all the one-loop Feynman diagrams. We're going to do a quadruple cut. So any diagram that doesn't have any of the propagators, we just toss them out. We're left only with the diagrams that have all four propagators. And on that side, we also have loop integrals. There's many of them, but no matter. Each one of them, we do the same thing. We do the same change of contours. And so when we do the contour integrals, we're going to get the same Jacobian on the left-hand side and on the right-hand side. And so we can just cancel out. That also means that whatever the overall normalization we chose for the contour, if I chose to wrap around it twice or wrap around it pi times, it doesn't matter because I'm doing the same thing on the left and the right-hand side, and that constant factor is simply going to cancel out. So what's going to happen on the right-hand side? We're going to get our coefficient. The coefficient itself is unaffected. It's just a rational function. It's unaffected by this cutting operation. We're going to get the coefficient of the box, and then we have these various normalization factors and Jacobians, which are going to cancel. And finally, the object that we're summing over the two solutions, well, it's just the coefficient. It's just the simplest possible polynomial 1 I could have written down. It's just 1. So if we, let's say, sum with, let's say we take the weight of A1 to B1, then we're going to get 2. If it makes you happier, I'll keep in the value of A there. So on the left-hand side, we're getting the sum of all diagrams, but because they have the propagators, we can separate them into 4 sets, and again, keeping 3 of the sets fixed, we can sum over all the diagrams in each of the corners. So we're building up diagrams that, for example, have this structure. I guess I kept leg 2 in principle off shell. Leg 1 and leg 4 were left on shell. Leg 3. So we're summing up all the sets of diagrams of this form that have these 4 propagators. And we can just keep this fixed and focus, for example, the sum on one of the corners. And so as we build up that sum, we're going to build up all the diagrams that have these given external legs and these 2 particular cut legs. And of course, the sum of all possible Feynman diagrams has a name. It's called a tree amplitude. Likewise, we can repeat this exercise at each of the other corners. These guys are a little bit special in this particular case because I've chosen them to be essentially 3-point amplitudes, so no need perhaps to fill in the circles, but the formula doesn't actually, the particular solution that we found can be generalized to the case where P1 squared and P4 squared are also sums of original momenta so that those squares are no longer 0. So what we have here, and let me maybe draw it a little bit more cleanly. Is a product of 4 tree amplitudes. Which I will label A, B, C, and D. So the solutions, the values of the momenta that go in here into the cut lines is determined by one of the solutions in C1 and by the other solution in C2, and we're supposed to sum over those. So we're going to sum over the solutions to the quad cut equations. We're going to take the product of the 4 different amplitudes running around the cut loop. Of course, we're going to get the Jacobian and the value of A, because the weight of A was just out front. And I've already misplaced the colored chalk. Oh. some. So let me cancel out the factors which are extraneous. Singular. So there's one remaining thing, of course. We always have to sum over the intermediate states. So if we have, for example, different particle species running around the loop, we might have gluons and fermions and other particles. And we certainly have different helicity states, so we need to sum over all those different helicity states and sum over the different species. And so that's the formula that we get over here. So this is, in fact, precisely the formula that was derived and with somewhat less attention to all the complex arithmetic, all the complex analysis, the formula derived by Brito, Cacciazzo, and Fung. So it says that the coefficient of the box is this sum over the solutions, sum over the helicity, and the species of this product of tree amplitudes going around the loop. So let's think about this formula a little bit. It's originally due to BCF. So first of all, at least for this one coefficient, we've accomplished what we set out to do earlier in the week, namely, we're able to express the result purely in terms of on-shell tree amplitudes. There are still virtual particles, but they're all circulating inside the loop. And that loop is going to be, this loop integral is just a universal object. It's something that you calculate once and for all. It's independent of the specific external states, the specific external helicities. It's independent of the internal states, the internal helicities, and so on and so forth. It's a Feynman integral. We're not getting rid of the Feynman integrals. We still have to evaluate those. The other thing that we see is that, in fact, because of the BCFW relation, each of these tree amplitudes, the recursion relation, each of these tree amplitudes, we could unwind into being built out of a variety of three-point amplitudes. So in fact, we've reduced the problem of the amplitude, or at least of this particular coefficient, to the problem of computing things in terms of three-point amplitudes, as we had, as was promised at the earlier, at the beginning of the week. And just as in the case of the BCFW recursion, one of the key ingredients to the magic is being able to do things in terms of complex momentum. So in some very loose sense, we've traded the off-shellness for the use of on-shell complex momentum. The other thing that's actually very interesting to note here, and that's the big difference with the original version one of the unitarity method that we explored yesterday, is that the three-point amplitudes, of course, they're written in terms of spinner products, and as I emphasized in the very first day, those are things you can calculate numerically. The BCFW recursions are things that you can calculate numerically. The same is actually true of the Behrens-Hilley recursions, which we haven't discussed. So these tree amplitudes, you never really have to write down an analytic formula except the one for the three-point amplitude. You can calculate it numerically. And then the solutions here you can find numerically. And then this product and the summation, this is just algebra. This is stuff that computers love to do, and they love to do it numerically. So we never have to do anything analytically if we don't want to. We can write a general purpose library that will compute these coefficients numerically. And that's in fact, one of the key ideas that's made possible the programs like the Black Hat program from which I showed you one or two results earlier in the week. So let me see here. Let me just mention how color organization goes at one loop. It's not that profound. Again, the objects that we're calculating here are color-ordered amplitudes. So when I'm writing that there, well, here I haven't really told you whether it's color-ordered or not, and in fact, the master equation holds one way or the other. But the minute we're starting to look at these particular ordered objects, we're really looking at color-ordered amplitudes. And here, again, we have the full one-loop amplitude is going to be a function of our external spinners, the external helicities, and some color labels. I suppose we should close the set. And here, depending on the color representations of various particles, we might imagine having a sum over the spins of the internal particles. And there's going to be some counting, which we could absorb into the color-ordered amplitudes if we wanted to. But the structure of the color coefficients is a little bit different depending on the colors of the internal particles. So we now replace the sum over the non-cyclic permutations by a certain S sub n semicolon C, which I will define in a minute. It's basically a subgroup that leaves a certain trace structure invariant. So we have a group theory factor, which depends not only on the number of legs, but within each number of legs, there's a whole collection. And this actually should be a C, excuse me, for color factor. And then there's the different color-ordered amplitudes. They're now not just labeled by the number of legs, but also by the different color structure. So if the internal lines are adjoints, then the first color structure, the leading color structure, is, let's say for the identity permutation, has a factor of the number of colors. And then it's the same color factor that we know and love from tree-level amplitudes, just a single trace. More generally, the other trace factors, the other group theory factors are double traces. I guess I can't raise that anymore. And if the internal one is a fundamental, so for example, in the case of quarks, then in fact, the sum is limited to looking at a single permutation, and there's no factor of n. It's just the same color structure as at tree level. So the thing that's very special about one loop is that everything can basically be built out of the coefficients of the first color structure. So out of the color-ordered amplitudes, which are the basic coefficients of a single trace structure, those are the objects that are implicitly being considered in the master equation, that there's a certain sum of permutations. It's actually related to the kinds of permutations that you've seen already in discussions of the BCJ, namely, there's sums over all permutations that keep the ordering within each of the two subsets associated with the different traces invariant. But I won't discuss that in any more detail. So this thing is going to be written in terms of permutations rho, let's say. That is not going to be true at higher loops, and there you're going to have to do genuinely distinct computations for the coefficients of different color structures. Okay, let's do an example. Which, if nothing else, you should, in principle, be able to reproduce this example on the back of an envelope over beers, perhaps tonight, as you're celebrating the end of the school. And something which would be unthinkable to do in a conventional diagrammatic approach. So let's look at computing a certain coefficient in a five-point amplitude. I'm going to look at a five-point amplitude. Well, they all have either MHV or NMHV configurations if they're non-vanishing at tree level. So let's just look at one that happens to have two adjacent negative helicity gluons. On the outside, we're going to compute the contribution with internal gluons. And we're going to look at the coefficient of a one-mass four-point integral, one-mass box integral. In fact, one-mass boxes are the only thing you can get in this particular amplitude, of course, because there aren't enough external legs to make more of the legs massive. So we're going to pick the box where legs 1 and 2 are sitting on one leg of the box, and where the remaining legs are, of course, each attached at one corner. So what we should do is write down our quadruply cut box, and we'll start to write down the legs. Again, of course, it's essential that the cut momenta be complex, because otherwise we'd be trying to do a physical cut in a channel that just has a three-particle amplitude, and for real momenta, that would vanish. The external momentum is real, so the internal ones had better be complex in order for us to get something non-vanishing. So we have two negative helicities over here. The remaining external helicities are positive. So we can now start to label the graph. Let's just use the convention that the loop momentum is flowing clockwise, and I'll label it by the external invariant that it's flowing into. So L4, for example, is the momentum at the top of the graph. So one thing we can see right away, because these are really just three-point amplitudes, but this is a full amplitude, of course, so there's in principle a summation over different things. We know that unless these two gluons both carry positive helicity, that the amplitude is going to vanish, because it would correspond to either an all plus or a single minus amplitude. So these two guys had better be plus. And remember that we have the convention that momenta are always outgoing. So as I cross the cut, it's now attached to a different amplitude, so it reverses sign. So helicity conservation actually manifests itself here by having opposite labels. And now we have to figure out what the labels are for the remaining ones. So let me call this one sigma 2 minus sigma 2 minus sigma 1 and sigma 1. And we have to sum over all the different helicity configurations. Well, instead of having 16 of them, we've gotten them down to 4, namely the two possible choices for sigma 1 and sigma 2. Let's make a little table here, sigma 1, sigma 2. Let's start with sigma 1 minus and sigma 2 minus. So can anyone tell me what the value of the product of amplitudes is for that particular choice? So if we have sigma 1 and sigma 2 both being negative, that means I have a plus here and a plus here. And that means that this particular three-point amplitude has all helicities identical, and in the Peary-Yang-Mills theory, it just vanishes. So this contribution, we just get nothing. Now let's suppose we look at the minus plus choice. So that one is now going to be this is going to stay plus, and this one is then going to be a minus. This one is going to be a minus, and this one is going to be a plus. All right, let's look at the let's look a little bit at these vertices. If we just look at this vertex alone, everything is happy. We have a minus plus plus vertex, so we know we have a non-vanishing amplitude. But we also know that that non-vanishing amplitude has a certain requirement. We have to satisfy momentum conservation, and that tells us that the spinner, lambda spinner, associated with L4, well, let me first of all write it out in the spinner product form. We know that the angle products of L4 and 4 has to vanish. So what does that actually mean? Well, it means that the two spinners have to be proportional. You can see that if you use the projective form that was used in Song Hei's lectures.
I'm sorry, why should that vanish?
Remember, we have a plus plus minus amplitude. It's expressed in terms of brackets, ordinary bracket products. But we have to satisfy momentum conservation. And the way we were doing that was to make all the angle products vanish. So I'm just taking the angle product of L4 with the angle product of 4, and that has to vanish in order to satisfy momentum conservation. All right, let's look at the next guy over. It's really the lambda spinner associated with minus L4, here it's L4 and there it was minus L4, but that's just a factor of I. It doesn't really change anything. Again, we have a plus plus minus amplitude, so now we have to have the requirement that L4 angle product with the lambda spinner for 3 vanish, and that means that lambda 4 has to be proportional to lambda 3. Well, proportionality is transitive, so this means that lambda 3 has to be proportional to lambda 4. But lambda 3 and lambda 4 are external data. Someone came along and said, please compute the amplitude for this value of the momenta or this value of the spinners. And in general, they will not have chosen this kind of proportionality. So the only way that these constraints can be satisfied is if this contribution also vanishes. And that's, in fact, a general rule that when you have essentially a single momentum, internal momentum to fix, that adjacent vertices have to have opposite chirality. So if this one has a chirality MHV bar, this one has to have chirality MHV in order to get a non-vanishing answer. So that tells you right away that there's another helicity configuration that's also going to vanish. That means that we're now down from our original 16 to a single helicity configuration, namely where both sigma 2 and sigma 1 are chosen to be positive. When I do that, then you can see I have three-point vertices, but they have an MHV bar chirality, MHV bar chirality in the middle. I have an MHV chirality, so everything is happy. The chiralities alternate. Okay, now we actually have to do a little bit of algebra. Not too much. I need to rescue this. Okay, we saw earlier that it was a clever thing to write the loop momentum in terms of the two neighboring spinners. And here we already know that one of those two contributions is going to vanish. We want to write things in terms of the one that's non-vanishing. And that one corresponds to L4 being proportional to 3U4. So that automatically satisfies the constraints L4 equals 0, L4 squared equals 0, L4 plus K3 equals 0, and L4 minus K4 equals 0, just as in the example we did earlier. And So that's three of them. We have one more, namely we have to impose the one on the opposite side, which is simply L4 minus K4 5 squared equals 0. That tells us what the normalization of this vector is, and we can write it in this case just in terms of angle products, because the equivalent of an additional leg is going to be massless. So now we have to, the formula we have for our different amplitudes, they're all going to be expressed in terms of spinner products. What we really want are the spinners for L4 and also for the other Li, not the vector itself. But it's just written as a product of the two. We can split it apart easily enough. And we know that you can rescale lambda by any value you like as long as you compensate the scaling of lambda tilde by the opposite amount. So it doesn't really matter where I assign this factor. And I've chosen to do it in one way. And so then we would get the following results. You can work this out, that you get L1 is equal to angle 5. L3, there is no L2, of course, because that propagator is missing. Angle L4, I've attached this factor to the angle spinner. There's no factor of 2 because that's eaten by the Gordon identity. This is proportional to angle 3. L5, again, is just going to be proportional to 5. Likewise, we can write down the bracket spinners. These have slightly more involved formulae. Let me leave a little bit of space. Okay, so now what we have to do is to write down our quadruple cut formula. So that's a formula that gives us this coefficient. So again, here are the two solutions. One of the solutions is actually going to vanish because of the helicity constraints. That's, of course, not true in general. You really would have a sum, a genuine sum over two terms. But that doesn't mean we get to change the contour and only use one of the contours. We still have to sum over the two of the contours, even though one of them gives a vanishing result, which in particular means that we still have our factor of 1/2. So we write down the product of the tree amplitudes going around our box over there. So we would have, for example, minus L1, 1 minus 2 minus L3 plus helicity, a tree with minus L3 minus 3 plus L4 plus a tree minus L4 minus 4 plus L5 minus. Plus and L1 minus. So we have the Park-Taylor formula for each of these amplitudes. We simply write them out. We have the appearance of various minus Li in various places. So if we have some spinner product of this with J, then remember that overall, when we multiply it times a bracket product, we have to get out a factor of a minus sign. We can just get rid of that minus sign inside the spinner product by replacing it with an I in front. Yes? Why are they the same? They definitely need to be proportional, right? Because the lower right-hand corner is an MHV bar class amplitude, so the on-shell condition is going to be satisfied by having all the angle products vanish. So they certainly have to be proportional to 5. And it could be there's a typo in my notes and there's a missing factor here. And if you find it, let me know. So when we write out those formula, do the substitution, we can then simply plug in the values of these various angle and bracket products for the spinners. So in the cases where they are proportional, it's just a transcription. Otherwise, it should be pretty clear. This is just some factor that will multiply the appropriate spinner product. And I won't do all the algebra in front of you, but I'll just write down the final answer. It's really just a couple lines of algebra to do that. You find that you have the following form: an angle 2,3 cubed times S3,4 times S4,5 divided by angle 2,3, angle 3,4, angle 4,5, and angle 5,1. So does that formula look familiar to anyone? I think you've seen it in two separate sets of lectures, so I should hope that it's by now familiar. Actually, the entire formula isn't familiar, but what is familiar is that you can write it in this form. It's just the tree amplitude for the same helicity configuration multiplied by a certain kinematic factor. It turns out that that kinematic factor happens to be the denominator that shows up in front of the box integral. So the box integral has, if we ignore the epsilon dimensions, there's dimension plus four from the integration, and there's minus eight from the propagators. So overall, it has to have dimension minus four. So whatever logarithms and dilogarithms you get have to be multiplied by some invariant or product of invariants with overall dimension four. And it so happens in the case of the one mass box that we're considering that the denominator that you get is precisely S34 times S45. What's interesting here is that you actually get the same coefficient, not just in QCD, which is the calculation that I've been doing for you, but also in N equals 4 supersymmetry. And the reason is that in this particular contribution, you have two positive helicity gluons attached to the same vertex. So if we had fermions or if we had scalars, then the helicity labels actually have to go the other way around, right? If a fermion line is going through a diagram, then it has to conserve helicity, but the momentum is flipping. That means that one of these legs would have to be plus and the other would have to be minus. And okay, helicity doesn't really make sense for scalars, but if you attach assign helicity labels to the appropriate flavor combinations in N equals 4 SUSY, then you find that the same statement is effectively true for scalars. So that means in the N equals 4 supersymmetry calculation, if I were doing the complete sum over the supersymmetry multiplet inside the loops, only this contribution would survive, the same contribution that survives in QCD. So in fact, we've done here not just the calculation in QCD, but also the calculation in N equals 4 SUSY. And it turns out that the all N result in N equals 4 SUSY is amazingly simple. So this, and here we can write it again for two negative helicity gluons with everything else being positive. We find that it's a sum. It's essentially, it's going to be minus, never mind the phase. It's the denominator of the box times the box. And then the overall coefficient is simply the tree level endpoint amplitude for the same helicity configuration. And it's not over all boxes, but it's over all two-mass easy type boxes. Of course, the one-mass boxes are considered part of that subset. It's just a degenerate case of the two-mass easy boxes. So when you multiply the box times its denominator in this form, you have something that's dimensionless up to dimensions of order epsilon, and this thing obviously has the same as the dimension, the appropriate dimensions for an amplitude, an endpoint amplitude. So this is actually a good point to stop and make some concluding remarks. So here we've looked at computing the integrals. There's a parallel kind of approach where you apply unitarity not to the integrals but to the integrands. It's known as the Ossola Papadopoulos-Petau formalism. It uses some of the same ideas, and some of the ideas in that approach are useful in numerical implementations over here. We haven't talked about triangle and bubble or rational contributions. And what happens in the triangle is that you have only three constraints. So when we solve the on-shell equations, then there's still a remaining degree of freedom. But it turns out that that Jacobian, which we were able to ignore over here, now depends on that remaining degree of freedom. So again, you can find a contour that will essentially identify a pole in that degree of freedom. And using that idea, you can write down similar kinds of formula for the triangle. For the bubble and for the rational pieces, it's possible to generalize these ideas, but the structure is more complicated. And the other thing that's in fact still an ongoing area of research is how to carry out the same procedure at two loops. And many of the basic ideas are similar. There's a basis of integrals. The basis is more complicated. You need a more complicated set of algebraic identities. But the idea that you're doing replacing the contours, that choosing appropriate contours around global poles imposes the cut conditions, that you need to find consistency conditions, and that you can then write down formulae of this similar form, that all goes on. So with that, let me actually stop and see if there are any questions.